Good morning. I was available today, so I wanted to come and see what Brian had to say. So I like to do that occasionally. It's nice. I really am delighted when I can hear people present, hear Susan Farrar, Mike Heffel, hear Brian, hear all the people that have presented. We're a unique Sangha that Sangha members are presenting to Sangha members, and that's the way we learn and the way we share. I have a few announcements. Susan just let me know that our Heart Lineage teacher, Jada Rinpoche, will be here in November as part of his United States tour. So do we have an exact date yet? No, but probably maybe the week before Thanksgiving, something like that. And then in September, coming up very shortly, Geshe Sawang and the Sarah J. monks from Ladakh will be constructing a sand mandala of Medicine Buddha here in the temple. If you've, some of the guests here today, if you've never seen a sand mandala, it'll be a unique treat. And for people that are doing the practice regularly, it'll be an encouragement and empowerment of their practice. September 16th, after the mandala is constructed, Kenshin Rinpoche, one of our lineage teachers, a very fine lama, will be giving the initiation, the Jainang, for Medicine Buddha practice. So I'm very fond of Kenshin Rinpoche. I'm fond of all my teachers, but he's been a wonderful sense of support and guidance for me. And very easy to hang out with. And he drives himself, so he's driving up from Berkeley area. So that's nice, huh? So we'll be sending out more announcements on that. But if you're not on our mailing list now, please include. We're very blessed to have, it's kind of funny to say it this way, but the real A-listers from the Vajrayana tradition coming here to Sacramento, the absolute creme de la creme of teachers within the Dalai Lama's lineage, let alone other teachers. So I'm very honored and grateful, and it's because of everyone's strong practice here that we have this opportunity. Yeah. So thank you. Now I get to say nice things. even though we haven't seen Brian that often on Sundays, I meet with him regularly, and I'm delighted that he's here today. As a householder with small kids, every moment of his life has a schedule and a meaning, doesn't it?
Yes.
So I asked him to speak about managing conflict. As a health professional at a hospital, he has plenty of experience, not only working as a team, but working with conflict and healing together. So not a formal scholarly talk today, but one from his own experience and practice. I'm also delighted that Brian and I put together a very comprehensive Vajrasattva sadhana that I hope we can, that are we doing for full moon practice, and can continue to increase. And maybe when he's done with his current schooling, he'd be interested in completing the or starting the foundations course. This is what you get for having the Lama say nice things.
Thank you.
several of our members here have done a two-year online course through Jamyang Center in London under the guidance of Geshe Tashi Sering, which is a wonderful teacher. And it's a fantastic online course. I'm very proud to say that a number of our members have done it. I'm going to chide them in a little bit. Right now, all the people who have completed the program, Susan and Deb and Ellen and Dana and Patty, yeah. So all very dedicated women practitioners. So men, you have to catch up. Greg Vigils just finished his first, what's it called, module, right? Yeah. Where are you with it? Very good, yeah. At this point in Dharma, it's really important, particularly in America, that we have equal and educated female teachers and Dharma representatives. We have some need to have all the human beings doing Dharma and teaching. So we should say male, female, and trans, right? All together. It's very important also in our tradition to have very dedicated householders and monks practicing together. Traditionally in Asia, householders weren't as educated or didn't do as much yogic practice as retreatants and monks and nuns, and that's changing in America. So our mission here at Lion's Roar is to have highly educated people, whether monks are householders or nuns are householders, and strong yogic practitioners. We're doing it. Fortunately, my senior teachers have had confidence in me to that I'm trying to do it, you know. I'm delighted that we're building that movement here in Sacramento. Also, I'm delighted that we're doing an absolutely clean, clear Dharma. It's impossible to do any study, any yoga, any social service without a strong ethical base, strong bodhicitta, you know, strong, transparent organization. So, you know, I'm delighted that that we have that, that everyone here, particularly people on the board, are committed to that program. So that's just kind of neat, you know. Totally proud of everyone here, and I'm delighted to hear what Brian has to say, and I've given him maybe 5 minutes now. No, we want some time for question and answers too, right? This is going to be important. Yeah. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here and being supportive. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's my plan. Yeah.
So again, thank you to Lama Yeshe Jimpa. Thank you to Jada Rinpoche. Thank you to His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and thank you to Lama Tsongkhapa and all of the lineage teachers. So I'm talking about conflict today, and I'm winging it. I noticed, you know, one of the things that Lama here likes to encourage me to do is tell personal stories, and I tend to be, at least as a springboard, a little bit more intellectual, have a more intellectual approach to things, right? So I'm still going to put a little bit in that there because I want to put some context for what I'm talking about. I got to thank Lama for, you know, allowing me to get up here and you know, putting my madness out front for everybody to see. I really do appreciate that. And you know, it's that's not to say that, I mean, you know, nobody's perfect, right? But we are all pure, and that's what Vajrasattva. That's Vajrasattva up there. That's why I'm pointing up there. That's what Vajrasattva really teaches us all, is that, you know, regardless of how you know, crazy you may be, because we've all got our little bit of craziness, we are all pure, and we can all, you know, achieve wonderful things. And here I am winging it, trying to achieve what hopefully is going to be a decent talk, right? So I noticed on the Facebook page, they said I was talking about conflict resolution. Actually, that's actually the exact opposite of what I'm talking about. What I wanted to talk about today is management of conflict. And that's because I'm trying to take a look at conflict in a larger context. I mean, certainly, let's say Susan and I have a row about something, and we're going to work through those problems, get through to the other side of it, and be okay. Okay, well, there's some resolution there. But resolution in the larger context of being in this world is an ever-present thing. That kind of conflict never goes away. You know, it's, you know, okay, maybe Susan and I get through one row this week, and then we have another row next week, you know? and that's, part of that is simply coming to understand that, you know, that's the way that the world that we live in works. We are in a world of suffering, a world of impermanence. And we try to do the best we can. And if you look at the Eightfold Path, that's, you know, well, even the Four Noble Truths, it talks about, okay, we're in this impermanent world. We have to come to terms with the way that this world works in order to then do the Eightfold Path. We have to do it realistically. We can't sit here and say, okay, I'm just going to be happy all the time and I'm never going to have conflict. That's not really the way it's going to work. And you're not going to get anything out of it unless you actually engage in that conflict in a compassionate and a creative way. Consciously or not, I think it happens to everybody just from the moment we're born onward, just experiencing the conditions of this life. And, you know, we are blessed that in this world we can experience all of the different emotions that are represented by the 10 worlds of, you know, like the hell beings, the hungry ghosts, the jealous gods, the gods. Everything that is represented by each of those worlds is something that we can experience here. And that is why the human birth is a very precious birth indeed to have. And that's why you want to make the most out of it while we're here, so that we can engage in this world as it is. The Buddha, when he became enlightened, he, you know, touched the earth and said, "The earth is my witness," right? Well, you've got to make the earth your witness. You've got to do things according to the way things work here and not in some way that you hope it would work. So I guess puts sort of a context into my whole concept of conflict. It's more than just conflict, I guess. It's the impermanence. It's wrestling with the impermanence. It's, you know, wrestling with people. It's wrestling also within yourself. You know, any time that you have a big decision to make and you're conflicted, I'm sure you probably have all heard the recommendation that, you know, you take a big sheet of paper. On one side you put all the pluses. On the other side you put all the negatives, right? And what you're doing is, you know, okay, you're kind of setting up a conflict there. You're laying out the conflict, trying to decide, okay, what exactly is this conflict? It's the pros versus the cons. But what you do is you're engaging in a conversation within your own mind between these pros and these cons to help you get a better picture of the idea, a better idea of what's going on, what you're trying to accomplish, and what you hope to achieve. And the same kind of thing applies when you're talking about not just within yourself, but also outside of yourself. You know, if you're going to have a creative argument with someone, a creative disagreement, then you're going to want to, you know, take a step back, not allow anger to dominate, although, you know, sometimes that's going to happen, and, you know, you work through that. Again, you don't ignore that challenge. It's okay to, like I try to tell my kids, it's okay to be angry, but it's how you express that anger that you really want to focus on. Not that I'm always successful with that, especially with kids, but that's something that you want to work towards, is saying, okay, yeah, it's okay to be angry, it's okay to feel whatever emotion it is you're feeling in the moment, but let's make sure that we can keep it creative, you know, keep it working towards a solution that's going to help everybody, you know. And in general, you want to try and do things that are going to be more healthy and more creative than, you know, things that are going to wind up shooting yourself in the foot. Those types of things are things that will only cause you and those around you more suffering. Yeah, here I am. I'm 48 years old, have some life experience behind me. I'm still moving forward, as Lama said. I'm still wrestling with school. Put myself in a conflict here, coming up here, more or less trying to wing what I'm talking about. I've thought a lot about it, thought about organizing it. Haven't really written much down like I usually do. So I hope that at least some of that thought comes through and is evident. But, you know, what are some of the things that I've experienced going through this life and, you know, these conflicts? How have I resolved them, or how have I lived through them, or you know, turned them into something creative, you know? And a lot of that is also, I think, simply the perspective that you're going to take on your life as well and your conflicts. Are you going to say, this conflict is going to bowl me over? Or are you going to say, well, I, you know, there's things that I can change, there's things that I can't change. Let me approach this in a way that is going to reduce the amount of suffering that occurs. Can't eliminate suffering. I was in the Air Force. Well, my dad was in the Air Force, I should say. So I'm an Air Force brat. We moved around quite a bit every couple of years. That's something that certainly has stayed with me. And back then, it had sort of a negative effect, at least for what I thought of myself in the moment. And of course, we're talking, you know, teenagers who will pretty much cling on to almost anything and turn it into a negative. But I really disliked moving around at that much. It was difficult to make a lot of friends. Well, it's a little bit of both. On the one hand, I can be very friendly and congenial with a lot of people. On the other hand, it takes a little bit more to make a really deep connection with somebody. You know, I value that, but it's I'm a little more protected in myself with that, from making those deep connections with other people. And like I was telling Susan this morning, Sangha is probably one of my weakest aspects of Buddha, of the three jewels that I participate in. And there, you know, maybe there's something to that, the fact that, you know, I don't make these connections very easily. But, Lamala has suggested a couple weeks ago, maybe seeing if my wife wants to help Tariko out with the childcare, which of course is, you know, once we've got more of a definite responsibility there, then I can come in and be here a little bit more often and actually maybe, you know, not shy away from the Sangha so much. Of course, not to say that we're not busy. We've got the kids, and one of my children has a medical issue, and I'll talk a little bit about that later on. But it's kind of funny, you know, some of the things that come out of looking back on this life and saying, whoa, okay, let's see. On Facebook, I'm involved in a couple of groups that do, like, music countdowns. I love music. And we were doing a countdown of songs from 1984. I was 14 in 1984. And at the time, I was very much sort of, coming into the whole idea of, oh, you know, women are something other than just another human being that, they're more than just another human being. Let's put it that way. Everybody who's gone through puberty knows something about that one way or the other. I was telling the story of this girl that I had a crush on, and you know, talking about, you know, my Air Force experience, how, you know, as you know, in a situation where my dad was in the Air Force, I wore glasses. I have had LASIK, you know, 15 years ago, but I used to wear glasses, and I hated glasses. I hated glasses for the longest time, and part of it was because of these experiences that occurred around here. You know, I didn't like myself with my glasses on. My dad would pick up these glasses, and they'd be like just a step up from the birth control glasses that you see folks in basic training wear. That's what they'd call them. Birth control glasses. That's what we call them in basic training. I was in the military for 4 years, Air Force. so yeah, they were really, really ugly. And the ones that I had back in 1984 were, you know, like very dark, and I wore my hair a little bit long. I probably looked more like a 70s drug dealer than anything else. But, you know, not that I had an awareness of that at that time, but that was sort of what it was like. They were just really ugly, ugly glasses. I think the Air Force, the basic training ones were a little bigger, and you know, maybe sort of a similar shape, but yeah, really ugly. Those look good. Yes, you see, I'm glad. I didn't like mine. Yeah, yeah. But I didn't like my glasses anyway. But I was telling the story about this girl and about how I didn't like my glasses, my whole experience of, you know, being in the Air Force and having all these, you know, things. And one of the folks in the group messaged me and said that, you know, he shared this with his wife, and his wife thought it was beautiful, brought tears to her eyes, because she was also an Air Force brat who knew exactly what I was talking about when I was talking about getting the glasses that were just a step up from the birth control glasses. And that, you know, to be able to look back and say, wow, okay, I mean, you know, it's not where I was. I was sharing songs and, you know, some of the women that I associate with these particular songs. Regardless of what kind of impact they actually had in my life or not, it was, you know, this is like the first serious crush I had. To go through that and then to see something, you know, something pulled out of it that was just completely innocuous, so I kind of thought it was just kind of a side part of the little vignette that I was telling. It really made an impact on me. You know, it's like, okay, first of all, look at all this. I've gone through, you know, this time wearing glasses throughout until I was like in my early 30s, and just absolutely, you know, having to deal with this part of myself. I wouldn't say that I'm self-loathing in general, but I did have this part of myself that loathed myself because of the glasses and the way that I looked. You know, back then I would, I had the LASIK, I shed the glasses, and it was kind of like a weight being lifted up off of myself. Now, of course, now I'm 48. I'm going to have to probably go back to readers at some point in time, but I've also grown beyond that particular feeling about it either. Maybe just having, you know, maybe it was just the simple act of getting rid of those glasses was enough to reduce that conflict in my life, and not to have them, you know, not to have to put up with them anymore for a while. You know, I always knew that, you know, eventually I would have to go back to reading glasses, or sometimes your eyes change just over time, and that'd be something that I would have to consider again is wearing glasses one way or the other. I wouldn't hate that so much anymore. You know, there's been a lot that's happened, not just simply, you know, the LASIK, but also just going through life and facing all these challenges that we have. Another conflict that's come up in my life was with my child from my first marriage. That's of course another thing that can, you know, get you used to dealing with conflict in your life is going through a divorce. One of my children from my first marriage decided there for a while that at the time she did not want anything to do with me. That's a difficult thing to deal with when you're a father who really cares about your children and, you know, really wants the best for them, whether they see that or not. Of course, she was a teenager at the time, so We've come to resolve our issues since, which is a good thing. But what occurred was during this period when she wasn't seeing me, she came out on Facebook as transgender. I don't have a problem with, you know, that particular lifestyle. You know, if this is who she feels she is and needs to express herself that way, that's great. I don't refer to her as a she anymore. I did that because back in that point in time, that's how she identified herself. Now, his name is Terrence, and I identify him as in the male, and with male pronouns that he prefers, and as much as possible trying to respect whatever wordage that he feels is appropriate. But he did this out on Facebook without reaching out to any of my side of the family. So it was sort of a double blow because, you know, couple of different things. Of course, I wasn't there to be able to support him and see him going through this change in this process. Since we've gotten back together and talked a little bit more, he kind of felt that I wouldn't have seen it back then anyway, or that I would have been a little bit dismissive of it. And, you know, that he's probably right in a certain fashion, because his whole reason for removing himself from my life at that point in time was because he claimed that, as the story went, his grandmother, his mom's mom, said, "Well, you're depressed," and then all of a sudden he's leaving the house. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to drag my ex-wife's family's name through the mud, but there's always conflict, right? And you know, I was. In the moment, I was more concerned that was a ploy that the grandmother was trying to make to, you know, get my child less involved in my life at that point. That's part of the other conflict of divorce is you know, trying to deal with these kinds of issues that come up and the struggle between, you know, someone who sees you a certain way other than, you know, you see yourself, and, you know, vice versa and whatnot. There's, you know, that's a whole, like I said, that's a whole other challenge, and I might get a little bit into that. We'll see. But what occurred was that this sort of spilled over into work for me. I'm an operating room tech. That means basically that I'm handling the instrumentation during a surgery, and I'm right there with the doctors, sterile, ready to help. You know, get my hands covered in blood every day. Well, my gloved hands, anyway. And I can also tell you that I work at Sutter General, and there's a certain contingent of surgeons that are really old school there. You know, some of them have retired and moved on. But there was one particular surgeon that he is just really, I don't see any kids in the room, he's an asshole. And I'm not the only one to think so. I mean, he sometimes can't even get other surgeons to work with him as his assistant because he is that abusive. Again, there's several views on this. Some of the, one or two of the anesthesiologists have sort of brought it up and casual conversation and you know, painted him as being very sarcastic, which is true to an extent, but, you know, when he's talking to the assistant and you know, saying the assistant has sausage fingers and can't do anything right, it's a little bit different to when you have to sit there and watch this happen. It was around the holidays, the Christmas holidays, maybe sometime between Christmas and New Year. And during those times, the regular assignments that we tend to have are a little bit upset because people are out for Hanukkah or Christmas or you know, just a holiday in general. So I'm dealing with my son Terrence, who's come out on Facebook as transgender and has not spoken to me in several months. He did stop over for Christmas very briefly, first time I'd seen him in probably 9-10 months. So it's very, there's a lot of emotional baggage going on there. I'm at work, you know, assignments are a little bit more loose. I'm assigned to work with this guy. Okay, fine. I'm working in an ancillary role that is not primary scrub. In some of his cases, he requires a secondary scrub. So I'm like, okay, that's fine. I'll deal with that. What occurred was, however, was that was a miscommunication, and for at least the very first case, I was supposed to be the primary scrub, and outside of the whoever's assisting him, the primary scrub is usually next on the target list for his abuse. I found that out. Of course, it wasn't really communicated very well during morning report. When I found that out, I'd had just about enough between, you know, personal life and having to deal with an abusive individual. And I brought my badge up to the front desk. I put it down on the front desk, and I said, thank you very much for the opportunity to work here, and I walked out. I had one of the managers, assistant nurse manager, A&M, if I use that term, that's what it means, who thankfully stopped me and talked me down from the ledge, so to speak, and at least got me back in so that I wasn't actually walking out and quitting like that. And I have a lot to thank him for doing just that. They did send me home for the day because obviously my behavior wasn't appropriate or professional. And surgeons are, you know, have a little bit more leeway for what they can do professionally. They're much more valuable to the hospital from one perspective than, you know, someone like me who spent a year. Now, it was 2 months and then a year on-the-job training versus the, you know, 10, 13 years that a surgeon spends training. And that, you know, so I mean, obviously, that's sort of a general concept that comes into play. You know, surgeons are much more protected. They haven't really put me into work with them all that much since then. What's that? I was, well, yeah. The manager came and yeah, he definitely helped, you know, prevent me from doing that. So I was protected in that sense. Yeah, but you know, I still went home. They wouldn't have sent the surgeon home. That's kind of the point that I'm trying to make. But yeah, I was protected. Yeah, and that was good. That was good.
I have a question.
Yeah. So
what Dharma practice and principles got you through the glasses and kid and hospital? What kept you going? What Dharma principles could you share that or recommend that you used?
Well, part of it is simply having the experience of these things and realizing, oh, is it Anna? Oh, okay, yeah. Part of it is just the experience of these things. I mean, I think that I've had a sense from my Darshan talks with Lamala that experience itself counts for a lot. And, I mean, of course, it's also what you do with it because you do want to be ethical. If you look at the Eightfold Path, what lies at the root of a lot of that Eightfold Path is self-discipline. And, you know, in a moment that I lost my self-discipline, you know, I had someone there to catch me and you know, keep me from going completely off the rails. But that's the exception rather than the rule for me. I mean, I've worked there for 9 years this month. And I've been doing this tech job for since 92, so 26 years. So that's more the exception than the rule for me in that instance. And a lot of that, I think, can be put down to the fact that self-discipline is the way that you can learn to, you know, have a balance. You stand where you're at, and you say, okay, this is who I am. This is what I'm going to do. Even, you know, even if I felt like I was getting beat up socially back in high school, I still had a sense of who I was, and that I was not going to give up or not going to fail, right? I'm going to work through it one way or the other. There are certain things that you know are coming that you just have to work through. You know, they're going to hit you, and you're going to have to do them, whether you want to or not. Growing up, becoming a responsible adult with children. I've got two batches of children. I've got two adult children from my first marriage, and then I've got three children who you guys will probably see back in this afternoon. So if you take a look at the Eightfold Path, right view, that is kind of like where your ethical system comes from. And I have been fascinated with ethics ever since a very young age as well. As a matter of fact, I still have writings from when I was like 13 or 14 where I envisioned this church. I called it the Church of the Universal Blood because I loved nature. I would go out to nature and I would look at these things, and a tree would look so much more real than a house, right? So I said, well, what is it about the tree? What is it about the animal? What is it about these things that are more real, seem more real than, you know, a house or, you know, a car? And for me, it was life, and so, you know, I thought, well, okay, blood's a really good symbol of life. Just about everything that's living has blood. So I came up with this whole thing about, the Church of the Universal Blood. My whole concept for the ethics of it was you'd come to a meeting, and you'd sit there and you'd work out any conflicts that you had with other people, you know, like kind of like almost like the concept of a sangha. You know, I know Lama and I have kind of discussed that concept a little bit. You know, you want to come to a sangha and you want to resolve things in a greater, from a greater perspective. You know, when I'm talking about, you know, trying to deal with myself and you know how I feel about glasses, when I talk about you know, dealing with my son or dealing with difficult personalities at work. When I, you know, talk about, you know, my ex-wife and some of the experiences that I've had with her that I don't really dwell on anymore because, you know, what's the point? all of these things, I try to approach with an ethical perspective and try to say, okay, you know, inherent to reality is freedom. We have freedom. You know, you're free to break the law or not. Laws are something that's man-made. Freedom is something that's inherent. And that's not to say laws don't have their place and their purpose, but what I'm saying is we have this freedom. What are we going to do with it? You know, when you're there, when you have a difficult choice to make, you know, oh, do I completely disown my son because he's decided he doesn't want to be part of the family anymore? Do I decide to disown him, or do I decide to say, okay, let me try and be patient because eventually he's going to grow up a little bit more, get a little bit more of his own experience under his belt, and maybe, you know, later on we can resolve things like it's happened.
Why don't we take a little break? Is that okay?
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure. Stretch,
and then come back and take some discussion.
Discussion questions. Yeah.
How long a break should we have? 10 minutes? Yeah. Let's do 10 minutes and then have a discussion.
Yeah.
That would
be okay.
Good. Yeah.
Oh, Susan had a good question she brought up to me over the break. Might be a good starting point. Whole play of the events. I think it's fair to say that bodhicitta is developed through ethical behavior in one part. I mean, if you talk about view and action and meditation as a way of summing up the Eightfold Path, well, you know, it's one thing to think about the ethics and say, okay, yeah, this is the way that I look at things, but action. If you don't act upon those ethics, at least within those areas of your life that you can control, then you're not going to necessarily generate bodhicitta. You know, I think a good way of looking at generating bodhicitta, one aspect of it is to live according to the ethical principles that you find appropriate in your life. And that's where I think the bodhicitta part comes in. And of course, Buddha nature is always there. We're always sort of looking out at the world and what's happening with us, and it's all impermanent, right? And sometimes it's not always easy to recognize the impermanence in it. That's where, that's Rigpa going back and forth. But that's where it can become helpful to do that. And that's where meditation can lead you to that point. It can sort of help disentangle you from these conflicts that you become enmeshed in so that you have more of a non-reactive approach to it after the fact. Yeah? Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I can so relate. I'm a medical provider and have scrubbed and circulated in ORs for many years, so I really get what you're saying. But I guess my question is, I don't really know so much where it fits in, the path, but would you consider humor in the, because the medical world is so bizarre and different than a lot of other things that we live in the world, would you consider humor as part of the path? Because sometimes that's how I've used that to avoid the reactiveness you're talking about.
Yeah, it doesn't work with everybody, like that one particular guy, or maybe it's just our personalities really, I mean, there might be a personality there too.
No, but I don't mean humor with him, I mean
right.
Humor with yourself to make you stop, and that I've used myself
okay.
to make
mm-hmm.
me stop so that I don't just, say, well, you are an asshole.
Yeah, yeah.
And
well, I do tend to use self-deprecating humor quite a bit in the OR, which, so that's kind of why I, thought that's kind of what you were talking about. But are you talking more humor about yourself?
Humor, just to remove you from whatever the reactiveness is that you're going to have in the situation, so then you have to stop and you say, you're laughing at yourself, you're laughing at the situation, you're realizing it's impermanent, but it's sort of that impetus that makes you stop and think in that moment, which otherwise can often, having been in that situation, be in just an immediate reactive moment.
Yeah. I believe with myself, I think I've come to something similar to that, where a lot of the times, I do sort of, take a humorous approach to things. Not, regarding myself, but also about the situation. So I agree with you on that. I think humor can be a very powerful tool for sort of in that very moment stopping and moving yourself out. I don't know. Is there anything in formal Buddhism about humor?
Yes. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah? Okay.
The bodhicitta is the. The spirit and the energy and the aliveness that we bring to life, and it manifests in compassion. but also manifests in absolute nature's complete wakefulness. So when the compassion and the wakefulness, the open, empty mind come together, there's a sense of humor, you see. So humor is generated through these different polarities coming together. So, that's things are kind of compassionately humorous. But not always ha-ha, but humor sees both sides of the situation, brings the contrast together. But ultimately, for me, conflict resolution comes down to bodhicitta. Like, can we develop enough compassion and empathy to work with people that have harmed us? It's very difficult. I don't know anything else that really works as well. This person had their hand up too.
All right, so going back to what you had asked when we first got back from break, Lama, about how you get through it. I'm recently divorced from someone I was with for 23 years, but married 16 years. And because I found out that he had molested my oldest daughter. Mm-hmm. And for the past year, I was so bitter and so angry. I've lost friendships because of it. And one day I just kind of stopped in this whole swarm of bitterness. And I said, this pain is not who I am. And I'm going to eliminate myself from this. And it's not like, poof, it's gone. It was more, I'm going to let myself cry when I need to. And what changed in me was the total transparency with others, because it was this secret that I was keeping. I didn't open up. I didn't ask for help. And so once I started opening up and telling my friends, this is why I'm being such a jerk, they were like, oh, okay. And so it was that understanding of this pain is not who I am. This bitterness is not who I am. It's what he helped create in me, but I'm slowly letting that go. But, you know, like I said before, that total transparency with all my friends was what changed in me. I've released that. I don't feel that anger anymore. I don't feel that bitterness anymore. Will I forgive him? Will I have compassion for him? No. I don't think I'll ever get there. It does help to kind of take that pain and see it outside of yourself and know that that isn't you.
Usually what you're giving me is a reason based on an insight into identity. That's not who I am. I want to release that identity. So that has a emphasis on what we call absolute bodhicitta, emptiness of self, right? It's strongest, however, when there's lack of solid fixation on our identity combined with, strong empathy, strong compassion, strong emotional connection. The compassion or empathy doesn't always have to be for a perpetrator, right? That compassion can be for ourselves too, right? So we're working both sides of the street. You know, we call it absolute and relative bodhicitta, but it's really the awareness side and the or cognitive side and the emotional side have to work together. Then you have a really strong glue, so to speak, like that. But people differ. I tend to work the emotional side first. I'm going to have to develop empathy first, and then I start seeing the emptiness of the fixation, like that. And you're working the awareness aspect first, seems to me. Yeah. Oh, you're using the microphone. That's like.
So I was thinking about, I guess, even before you started talking about what you said, I think relates to what I was thinking about, which is when I think about conflict, and anger generating conflict, it comes from this, I think, the aversion, right, of the three poisons. There's such a, I've really been thinking about the fear basis to anger. You're going to take something from me, or, there's like this poverty mentality to anger, if you will. Like, it's not a, compassion's like the antidote to anger, like, that equanimity and not holding some close and others distant. And the, you know, when someone's perpetrating something upon us, of course we're going to have a reaction. But I think one of the things that helps me is to recognize that that's coming from a place of suffering for them, that they're maybe attacking me out of their aversion and their fear, and I don't have to condone that action. I don't have to agree with it, and I can stop it, but I can have compassion for the fact that they're suffering, if that makes any sense. You know, I was thinking, like, with your son, I wondered if he was pushing the family away for fear that they would push him away.
Well, that's possible.
The best defense is a good offense.
That's a good insight, I think, because looking at it, once he realized that I was going to be accepting of his choices in this, that just start testosterone and to have a hysterectomy and mastectomy. Once he saw that I was accepting of that, that I was willing to use the preferred pronouns to try to adapt my language as much as possible. We went to the Pride Parade last year, and actually, he thought we were just going, but we actually marched in it with the Sutter Group. So I think you got a big kick out of that. a lot of being able to support him, I think, has been a really good way to sort of help bring him back and say, hey, yeah, we're not going to push you away because of this. Well, not me, my parents maybe, but that's a different story.
I think with surgeons, there's a bit of a hero mentality, like we're saving lives and. It's on us if we don't save this life, and so the people around, the ancillary staff are going to reflect, if something goes poorly, on that sense of who they see themselves as. Because I think I've worked with surgeons too, and I think they don't see themselves as anything other than surgeons most of the time. They don't have a balance in their lives. Yeah. And
I'd even go so far to say some of them have that God complex too, not just the hero complex, but the God complex. That's not to say that it takes a certain personality to do that job, some of the things that they have to sacrifice socially, a lot of them have just sacrificed their whole college social life to. This one focus on what they're doing. It's actually pretty incredible in a lot of ways, but it leaves its mark in a lot of ways on some of them as well. But there is talk, from what I hear, there's a lot of talk amongst the new surgeons about that life work family balance. So it's becoming more important in some of these roles that are. That are, basically you dedicate your life to.
I'm wondering, I currently work with a colleague who I have difficulty with because we're different personalities and different styles. And so I was curious, like, in the moment when you experience, like, a difficulty like that, in the moment, what helps you for me going down the rabbit trail of resentment or that kind of wanting to gossip because I'm frustrated and I don't know in the moment how to feel okay inside about whatever I need to do to have compassion but also to feel okay about addressing it. that's a skill I want to continue to learn. So.
Yeah, okay. Well, from my own experience, I think I have compassion for myself in that moment. You know, I'll feel all those things. I won't reject them outright. But the question is, how do I act on them, you know? And that's, I think, you know, I'm not afraid to say or feel, oh, I really don't like this person that I'm struggling with. I mean, everybody I think has had people that they don't work well with. You know, I can think of, you know, not that particular surgeon, but there's someone else, not this particular job either, that I can think of that I had that sort of thing with. We were, you know, more on the same level rather than, you know, having someone who's, you know, higher up in the hierarchy. For me, I guess I also have a little bit of an aversion to conflict, a little bit, not a whole lot, but a little bit. And so I'd rather sort of try and smooth things over in terms of my actions, right? But what I really try to do is, going back to this whole concept of, you know, freedom is inherent in reality, is to recognize, okay, this person is free to be that. This person is likely suffering in some way that causes them to be that, whether I see that or not. In social psychology, there's a particular bias that we have. I'm not sure if I'm going to remember the term for it right now, but it's where you see someone doing something and you assume something about their motivation that might not be true. For example, you're driving down the highway, somebody goes zipping by you and cuts you off, and all of a sudden you're like, darn driver. But what if they are on their way to a hospital because their wife's in labor and they need to get somewhere quickly? Sometimes there's, you know, yeah, okay, sometimes there's an obvious reason like that that doesn't match up with our own concept of what their motivation is. You know, sometimes we just don't know what's going on with someone. So if you try and have compassion and say, okay, yeah, okay, this makes me uncomfortable, you know, yeah, that's valid. But it's also valid that whatever is going on with that individual, they're also uncomfortable with it, you know. And that I think having that kind of compassion and that saying, yeah, okay, I understand, all right, even if you don't say it out loud, but if you at least hold that thought, I think it'll come through in your actions.
I'm going to jump in here because we're coming out of time. I'm going to make a pitch for Dona Dargye, the temple, and of course Lion's Roar. The model here is evolving nicely because, proud to say, in many cases here we have enlightened conflict. In other words, we have choices that are different, but they're both, or three or four, they're all good choices. So, for example, we are forming a garden around the temple here, right? So we have some conflicting ideas about, you know, where should we plant things, where should the walkway go, what color should we have? And they're all good ideas. So it's we're entering that world of enlightened conflict. And we also are in the process of needing to refinance the temple and pay off the note to the former owners, the Armenians. So we have different options, and that's enlightened conflict. We need to create a model in order to get out of destructive conflict. And one of the main purposes here at the temple is to show that actually we can have differences, and they can all be good ones. But we still need to develop the wisdom to know what's going to have the longest and greatest impact, and we need to develop the compassion and empathy to include others. Because one of the aspects of non-compassion and non-empathy is that we exclude. So I'm very happy that here at the temple, if you want to learn enlightened conflict, this is an excellent place. Because we have a variety of really good options we need to see that model. We can't just work with destructive conflict. We need to see that actually things can work out. So I'm delighted that we had a chance to talk today, you know, and thank you for sharing from the heart, Brian. It's there'll be others that will be called upon to share, and I appreciate that heartfeltness.
Well, I appreciate everybody that shared from the heart today as well, and the questions. But you know, it was more than just me sharing from the heart.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. That's it. That's absolutely good. That's modeling creative, managing creative conflict. So we should do a dedication, right? You can lead us in that.
Yes, that's on page 14. 15, actually, is the English. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig, Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. May the teachings of the Buddha flourish, and may the upholders of the teachings remain forever. May all migrators achieve happiness, and may they fulfill all their temporary and ultimate goals. Losang, magical display of the deep awareness of all the victorious ones, merciful giver of a stream of profound and vast instructions to the fortunate migrators, please remain always unperishing, unchanging, unfading. Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of objectless compassion, Manjushri, master of flawless wisdom, Vajrapani, destroyer of the entire host of Maras, Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the snowy land sages, Losang Drogpa, I make request at your holy feet.
Do we have any announcements?
We have coffee and tea and snacks in the community room. So everybody's welcome to come back and say hello.
I will be here, and also next month we'll be doing a book club again. This time we're adjusting it a little bit, so it'll be on the 23rd, because the Sunday before that, Genshin Rinpoche will be here, and next week, Susan, you're talking, right? Yeah? No. Oh, Charlotte, very good. Oh, yeah. Oh, okay, good. I won't, yeah, we'll see. Okay, good. We should, that's a good conflict. Yeah, which one? Yeah, so, yes.
Just today's full moon, so if you'd like to join us for lunar practice tonight, please do, 9 o'clock. Yeah.
I'd like to thank people for their generosity today and remind those that would like to be continuous generous that we do have a wonderful, transparent money system here, a plexiglass. You know, we're transparent about our right livelihood. This is also a very unique temple and Dharma Center for America because we do run entirely on Dana Paramita, on freely giving. We ask people to make monthly pledges so we know how to budget, but we welcome everyone. This is very classical. I don't know a lot of centers that are running just totally on giving. So for those that have given greatly, I really appreciate. For those who want to learn how to do Dana Paramita, this is also a good place to learn. So, Omahung.
Lama.
Yeah.
Did you have a something that you wanted to announce? I saw your hand go up. No, behind you? You? Yeah? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you.